This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. In this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, Women Working Construction, we talk with master electrician and poet Susan Eisenberg. In 1978, Eisenberg was one of the pioneering women who entered the construction trades. Today, some 20 years later, women in construction are still a rarity. Women's share of that workforce, just over 2%. Your questions and comments for our guest are welcome this afternoon. Join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Outside Champaign, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. And just for your information, these are not our pledge phones. So if you call us at these numbers, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL, that'll get you right into the program this afternoon. Let me tell you a bit more about Susan Eisenberg. Her articles and essays have appeared in The Nation, Utney Reader, and Sojourner. She is the author of three books: It's a Good Thing I'm Not Macho, Pioneering, Poems from the Construction Site, and We'll Call You If We Need You, Experiences of Women Working Construction. Pioneering and We'll Call You are published by ILR Press, an imprint of Cornell University Press. Again, those numbers, toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL, and in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Susan Eisenberg, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be there.
How did you decide to train to become an electrician?
Well, in 1978, there was really, in the sort of mid to late 70s, there was a real push to really open the question of what can women do and why can't they do everything. I was looking for a skill that could make a good wage and that was interesting, and electrical work is really combines physical work and mental work in a way that I find really challenging. And there was a training program that was open that was funded by CETA in 1977 that was a four-month training program in construction skills for women that I was able to be a part of and learn about carpentry, electrical, painting, and plastering, and found that I really liked electrical work and tried to get in the union in 77 to get an apprenticeship and was told that the unions didn't want us women, the contractors just didn't want them, and We'll Call You If We Need You, which is where the title of the nonfiction book comes from.
We'll Call You If We Need You. And when you hear that, you can expect never to be called.
Yeah, well,
Pretty much. What happened,
though, is in April of 78, Jimmy Carter issued an executive order that opened construction to women, and I got a call on a Friday saying, in April of 78, saying, be here on Monday for an interview, and that's how I got in.
Yeah. That order was then very effective. Can you tell us a little bit about President Carter's executive order? What did it say? How was it that that order opened up the trades to women?
Well, it really recognized the importance of jobs, of women having the ability to have jobs at high wages by, and recognize that a lot of construction work is really publicly funded work or publicly supported work, and that that was important that that be available to everybody. And it actually looked at, it addressed two issues. There were two separate parts of it. One was recognizing the importance of apprenticeship opening. So there were guidelines that were set for women to be about 20-25% of every apprenticeship class. So that it said that women should be in any apprenticeship program equivalent to half their representation in the workforce. So if women were 50% of the workforce, they'd be 25% of an apprenticeship class, since that's a really important avenue to get into training and to get these skilled trades. And the other piece of it was that women had to be represented on jobs. And it was set up as something that kept increasing. So it started in 78 as 3.1% and moved by 1981, or 3 years later, to be 6.9%. And it was set up as low and to be increasing just since there were so few women trained at that time. And it was meant at that when it was written to be something that would keep increasing as more women were in, coming in through these 20 to 25% of every apprenticeship class. So it really put out the word that of I think a real serious intention that to really move these jobs from, you know, what's quote unquote non-traditional to being really accessible to women. What happened was that the Carter administration switched to the Reagan and Bush era, and all the support for affirmative action was really pulled away, so that the monitoring, the kinds of training programs that really gave women a hands-on exposure, the kind of recruitment efforts that were going on, a lot of the funding for all of those things were, and monitoring of jobs was pulled away. So, which really happened before women even graduated, the first woman from apprenticeship program. So the effort was very short-lived, but I think was very strongly felt.
Now, others might suggest that women really don't want these jobs, that women aren't good at these jobs. Any truth there? What's your take on those kind of statements?
Well, that's really what drove me to write the nonfiction book, because I felt like obviously the figures are pretty dismal, so that you know, that women are still only 2.5% of the workforce, and that really begs explanation. And I think that the official explanation is that oh well, gee, women were given this chance, and you know, they're not that interested, and they're not that capable. So that's why who I interviewed for the "We'll Call You If We Need You" was women who came in at the beginning and who really know the trade. And I think their experience and their perspective really contradicts both those things. That I think women have the same kind of draw and passion about these jobs that men have. That obviously there's the money is a important factor, but there's also just the excitement of being able to really do something concrete, to go from a hole in the ground to a building that you can drive by and point to that you did, and to really have a skilled trade that you can do anywhere.
And there's a lot of pride in the trade, in the craft.
Oh yeah, and so I think that's, you know, that's really there. And you know, I mean, women do plenty of jobs that are heavy and hard. I think the problem is when women try to do jobs that pay well, there's a lot of resistance to that. And I think women are very, it was one thing that I asked everybody was, do you think women can do this work? And people felt yes. And this is people who really know the craft and know what's involved in it. One thing that becomes hard is to learn these trades, you need to be trained. So that, that's certainly an issue that I tried to look at in the book, is how women have been kept from a lot of the training avenues, that when it's a lot of the training is, some of it is in school, but a lot of it is on the job. And it really means a contractor having a commitment long-term to employing somebody and being willing to put them in situations where they're going to learn and have that opportunity. So it's an investment. So that's where the requirements for hiring women are really important, because otherwise, you know, you're just being hired for a short time and in and out, and there's no investment in your training, so that you are not fully capable sometimes.
I want to tell our listeners a little bit about that book, that nonfiction book that you're mentioning, We'll Call You. It's the result of an oral history project involving 30 women that our guest Susan Eisenberg began in 1991. 28 of these women appear in the book. Susan, maybe you'd give us some idea of who these women are and the number of trades that they represent.
Well, they're from five trades, because I spoke to women across the country, so from 10 states in the District of Columbia, so I wanted to limit it a little bit. And so the women who I interviewed are carpenters, electricians, ironworkers, painters, and plumbers. Because I sort of felt that ran the gamut of issues of strength and the kind of range of skills that present themselves.
And how are their stories similar and how are they different?
Well, what I feel like is that in a way it's all really one story that has a lot of variations. So I wrote the book that way rather than being one person's story after another that would emphasize how different they are. The book follows everybody from the 70s when people were, what you asked me, what made you think about getting into this? So the first chapter, Footings, asked that question, where were people coming from that brought them to the trades? And people came from all different kinds of backgrounds. Some people had a lot of training in tools and were very familiar, you know, grew up with that. Some people never touched a tool in their lives, didn't know. One woman who was a plumber said she became a plumber, didn't even know, knew the you flush the toilet. That's about what she knew about plumbing before she became a plumber. And then it follows everybody through their efforts to get in and their efforts to get trained and issues around violence and hostility on the job, issues around being able to work when they were getting paid the full rate, being able to move up in the trade, and then people's decisions to stay or leave. And it looks at differences for women of color. But I think what seemed important is that I think at this point, people really, all the tradesmen tend to feel their story might be different because, you know, they happen to be luckier this way or that way, or but that there's a real recognition of everybody. One person can recognize their own experience in each other's story. Like one woman who, a plumber from California who read the book, called me up and said that she knew or had experienced herself every story that was in the book, that there was a real recognition of a community experience.
One of the things that I admire these women for, incredible tenacity. They hang in, they hang on, and they work hard. And the opening chapter, as you mentioned, Footings, features the stories of how women got into the trades. And one of these stories I'm just blown away by, Gayanne Wilkinson, Boilermaker. Tell us about her experience. Perhaps you would share with us her words about, you know, the story that she told you. Share some segment or segments of
okay,
that
sure.
story with us.
Well, it picks, the Footing chapter picks her up in the 70s where she has four children and a house and a husband, and the economy is pretty shaky in Massachusetts, and she goes to look for work and finds that all the sort of traditional women's jobs are very low-paying and require clothes she doesn't have. So she takes advantage of her being a veteran and gets training as a welder at the Four River Shipyard. And she's actually was the first woman to return to the shipyards as a welder after the Rosie the Riveter women were sent home after World War II. So why don't I pick up there? So then she becomes part of a crew of six women who are getting trained there as welders. Okay. But an indication of the way it was going to go came the day we went into our assigned area and we were given these wooden toolboxes. We were told to pick them up and bring them to the laydown area where we were going to be working. We had a very young male foreman, and we got about half of the way over, and one of the young women was having real difficulty carrying her toolbox. She put it down and sat on it, and he very nicely picked it up for her and put it on his shoulder. She had explained already there were two women who were about 19 and the rest were in their 30s, so this man is picking up the 19-year-old's toolbox. At that point, I told the other women, put your toolboxes down and sit on them. We did. He came back and said, excuse me, but get those toolboxes. And I explained to him, if you're carrying her toolbox, you'll carry all the toolboxes. And we sat there for the rest of the day on those toolboxes until he picked up every single one of them. I think it was almost an instinctive thing. I mean, the men there just thought this was a joke. There were whistles, catcalls, everybody's waving. I just decided that, as far as women go, or my particular crew, I can't say I really thought women on the whole, if we didn't set some guidelines real quick, this thing was going to become a joke. And it was very important to the women who needed the job. I needed the job myself. While I was working in Four River, my husband had gone out to work in Michigan, and Michigan was a strong union state. He called me because they needed certified welders for the Boilermakers, and with my certifications, he certainly felt that I could go to work. This would mean going from $5.35 an hour to $21 an hour with union benefits. I arranged for a sitter for my children, and I drove to Detroit. I went out to the Boilermakers hall, walked in, and I said, I understand you're hiring welders. They said, yes, real excited. Who's this for, your husband? I said, no, I'm the certified welder. Immediately, everything got very quiet. This very angry man came out and said, I have to hire you because we've told you there's a job available, but you won't last 3 goddamn days, I guarantee it. The next morning, I reported a power plant 140 miles north to the steward on the job who already knew I was coming. The first man that we came to told this man to get his paycheck. He would not work with a woman. Put his tools down, and that was it. This happened with 2 other people. Finally, there was this young fellow who said, I can't quit. I need the money. I'll work with her, but I will not talk to her. I will not eat lunch with her, have my coffee break, blah, blah. Listed the whole thing. She can work, he said, but we will not be partners. For 3 weeks, no one except the general foreman spoke to me. If I sat down, everybody would move to another area. If I went up to work, they would actually try and move their work. It was getting very discouraging, very depressing. I was working 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. My husband had gone home to be with the children, so my only contact with family was by telephone. It was very lonesome, and there were no other women. I mean, no other women. At the end of 3 weeks, we had this one particular job where you had to go between the 13th and the 12th floor and weld what they call a buck stay to the boiler. You had to be able to do it left-handed and holding a shield. The man who was supposed to be my partner couldn't get his arm in there between the floors, so I told him, I'm going to put the safety belt line on, and you're going to have to hold it. He looked at me very strangely, and he said, you're going to let me lower you between the floors? I said, whether or not I live or die is going to be totally up to you. You are my partner. This work is our responsibility, and I'm the one that can fit in there. So I'm going to hand you this end of the rope, I said, and I'm going to more or less take on faith the fact that you will not let me go. Between the grating and the boiler, it's just open all the way down to the bottom, 13 floors straight down. I took my shield in one hand, I put my glove on, I got the welding rod ready to go, and I said to him, lower me down. And it was like this very pregnant pause. I went down, and I'm here, so we know he held on to that rope. When I came up and undid the harness, he asked me if I would like to go for coffee. It was the first human contact with any kind of civility to it at all. I acted like the 3 weeks just hadn't existed. Went for coffee.
That is such a story. Is that, in your experience, what kinds of themes ring in with your experience as an electrician? There's the hanging in there. We mentioned that.
Well, I think that that situation just come up, and you really have to. When she talks about back in the shipyard too, of just needing to make it clear that it's not a joke, and that I know I used to do, I also did theater while I was an apprentice. I would never tell people other things about myself because I felt it was so hard to convince people that I was serious about being an electrician. So I think one of the women that I interviewed was actually played cello in the, or bassoon, I'm sorry, in the symphony in Kansas City, in a local symphony. And never told people. Like, so there was a lot of isolation because it was so hard to be seen as serious about the trade you were in.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a real the effort and wearing, and the whole thing of proving yourself, I think, was in everybody's experience.
Gay Wilkinson really shows a lot of smarts there, where she says, let's sit down on these toolboxes.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you let that situation happen the first day out, you never get that opportunity back.
Right.
I thought that was really smart, and I thought, this is a woman with a lot of chutzpah.
Actually, I liked how she told the story, too, because now she's very conscious of all these issues for all women, but that she really could, that at that point, it was really just for herself and this crew, she knew how important the job was, and it wasn't larger than that. It was, and I think a lot of women also talk to that of what the woman said was like, I didn't mean to be a pioneer. I didn't mean to do all this. I just wanted this job, and I wanted this skill. And it just was a large situation to walk into.
Yeah.
And I think that's a real difference of that for men, they could just want to be a carpenter or want to be an electrician and just have the trade to take on. And for women, it's a lot been taking on a lot more than that, so that your desire to do it has to be stronger than it should have to be.
It's got to be pretty fierce. Because, as you know, this gay's story points out, it's lonely, and you can be in line for a lot of disrespect.
Yeah, what I found, though, too, and is that whole idea of how powerful and fierce people were, and the sort of, I remember when I was a third-year apprentice, my business manager calling us pioneers of the industry, and how I thought, well, that just seemed so attractive and heroic. And what I came to feel a lot later is there's something that's seductive about that, but not that useful, because it's really important to look at, it wasn't this empty landscape. You know, there were really, mostly people were in unions, or often in union situations, working for contractors, working under a federal mandate, really. So there were all kinds of institutions that really should have been there alongside us, making the way easier, and it should never have depended so much on individuals having to rise to the occasion and, you know, doing such dramatic things as you know, the story Gay tells.
Mm-hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, and our guest in this portion of the program is Susan Eisenberg. She is a master electrician and a poet. In 1978, she was one of the pioneering women who entered the construction trades. She is the author of three books, including It's a Good Thing I'm Not Macho and We'll Call You If We Need You, Experiences of Women Working Construction. That's a nonfiction book. It's an oral history. As I mentioned, this is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to talk with us this afternoon, if you've got questions or comments, give us a call. Talk to the guest. Toll free, the number 1-800-222 WILL in Champaign-Urbana, 333 WILL. That's toll free 1-800-222-9455, and in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. What's it like being out there first day on the job after you've had some basic training?
Well, I'll read you my poem, First Day in a New Job Site. But it actually, often people go on their first job without any training. I felt I was lucky being in a pre-apprenticeship training program that did give me some hands-on just exposure to tools and a little bit about how different trades fit together. But you can just go on to a job site and be learning straight first day on the job and really not have any training. But
let me ask you this, too. I think we need a little background here. What happens during the course of an apprenticeship program?
Sure. It's a little bit complicated to answer, but because every trade is different and things are different region to region, where women really tried to break in was into union jobs, because the unions tend to have very good training programs. And when I went through, it was a four-year training program, which meant that we went to school two nights a week and did classroom work, and that developed over the years, you know, to learn how to do motor controls, things like that. And then you're working on the job 40 hours a week under the supervision of a trained journeyman. So it's both a hands-on training and a classroom instruction. And some apprenticeships are 3 years, some are 5 years. They sort of, you know, that varies. But the basic idea is it's both a classroom instruction and a hands-on training.
Mm. You mentioned someone who became a plumber earlier in the interview, who she sort of picked the trade at random, and she didn't know very much about it at all.
Mm-hmm.
If someone like that goes out on a job site, you know, without any kind of training beforehand, that's really frightening.
Well, I guess that's a question of how you're treated and how the institutions work. Because I mean, what she sort of said is, I applied because there was an opening. I was interested. I always wanted to work with my hands. I passed the test. I was picked. They didn't tell me I had to know anything. So you really can learn in a organized training program, and that can be just like the way you can learn to drive a car. On the other hand, it means you're also very vulnerable, so that if somebody doesn't want to train you, if somebody doesn't think people like you should be there, you are incredibly vulnerable to danger. As somebody told me, it puts a hostile workplace in a whole different light. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about an inherently dangerous industry, which construction certainly is.
Would you now read First Day on the Job from Pioneering Poems from the Construction Site?
Sure. First day on a new job site. Never again a first day like the first day, that very first one, when only the sternest vigilance kept the right foot following the left, following the right, following the left, each step a decision, a victory of willpower over fear, future over past. Margaret's out there. Keep going. She's been working a few weeks already. She's managing. Keep going. The legs buck. L.A., Seattle, Detroit, women passing through construction site gates for the first time. Keep going. Right following. Go home if you want, but tomorrow. What do you do for work tomorrow? Left following right up to the gate, where a man hands me hard hat and goggles and points me toward a trailer where the conversation stops as I enter. Well, what'll we talk about now? Can't talk about girls. And then Ronnie, the one with beady eyes and a gimp leg, who knows for a fact one of the girl apprentices is a stripper in the zone, says to my partner, give me your apprentice. And I follow him, tripping over cinder blocks, to a small room where he points to the ceiling. I need some hangers 11 inches off the ceiling. Here's the hilti. The rod and strut are in the corner. The ceiling's mark where I want holes drilled, and leaves without explaining. Hanger, rod, strut, or seeing that the bit on the heavy drill barely reaches X marks on the ceiling when I stand tiptoe on the ladder's top step. Knowing which words to use, what jokes to banter, how to glide the body through dangers without knocking anything or anyone. Learning to speak first and define the territory of conversation. Passing. Another first day, the job new, the workers all strangers, all men, myself the only female, and yet we find almost easily the language that is common. Get me some 4-inch squares with 3/4 KOs. Need any couplings or connectors? No, but grab some clips and C-clamps and some 1/2-inch 1/4-20s. Passwords. You know what you're doing in a panel? Sure. Mechanic to mechanic. Never again a first day like the first day.
First day on a new job site. A poetry from Susan Eisenberg, our guest this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. Thanks for reading that for us.
Oh, sure.
We have a caller waiting to talk with us on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Susan. I'm really glad that you're a guest on today's show, and I really like your poem. I actually am working as an apprentice to a master painter right now, and I just started 4 weeks ago, so I can really relate to some of the what you're talking about, the social aspects of being on the job, and how do you make conversation when you're the only woman with 5 men. Those really ring true to me, so I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
I was just wondering, I have a question for you. I'm thinking of going into the tile laying industry, and I'm wondering if you could offer any advice to a woman who's interested in that field. What advice would you give to someone who's just beginning? I'll go ahead and hang up and just listen.
I guess I can't say anything particular about that trade. I think what seems useful would be to find other tradeswomen in the area, if there are networks or tradeswomen groups, and to find women who may be ahead of you in that, who could give you, you know, more information and particulars about the tools and what to expect.
Mm-hmm. The climate, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think the question is, yeah, what kind of support you get from the people you'd be working with, and to have the support that you might want.
I want to thank the caller. Question and comments. Other calls are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Susan, in the introduction to We'll Call You, you write, I'm going to read from the book here, in the interviews and in editing and arranging them for this book, I tried to draw on my training in the trades, in women's studies, and most of all, in poetry. Talk with us, if you would, about pulling together and pulling from these elements of who you are in order to do this book.
Well, I think there's a number of ways that I think about the book. One was certainly using what I know about the trades to try to hear what people were saying, because I think the strength of an interview is often limited most by the interviewer rather than the interviewee, that everybody really has something very important to say, and especially on a topic like this where you're trying to understand what happened and what went wrong, that everybody has an important story. So I think being familiar enough with the trade was certainly helpful to know what people were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess would say pulled on the women's studies background to understand what's important here and what are the ways that this issue is getting framed, and in a way the long-term way that it's important for it to be framed, that you have basically a policy that said we're going to throw open the doors to women, and some people would say they were, you know, women were given this opportunity on a silver platter and everything had everything going for them, and geez, it didn't work, so that must show that women aren't capable or interested. So that felt like something historically important to disprove. And that's sort of the women's studies voice, is that as this history is gelling, important to bring to the public conversation experiences of women,
a way of setting the record straight.
Yeah, before it's, I think what happened with the Rose of the Riveters in World War II is it got set in a certain way and looked at as like, oh, women just left voluntarily, and it really wasn't until much later that that history was revised and said, well, no, they didn't just leave voluntarily. Many of them wanted to stay and weren't allowed to. So that I felt aware of that as somebody who's studied women's history. And I felt like, well, we didn't really win the battle, but it's important how we understand it, and that's another piece of it. So those voices and...
The poetry.
The poetry, what I felt, what felt important to me, I guess, was that people feel the experience and sort of come through the construction site gate with women and what that felt like to walk in there and what that felt like to try to stick it out and to really understand why a woman, even though it's very hard, might choose to stay, and why a woman, even though she might like the work very much and really like that income very much, might choose to leave. So to really hear in a very present way people's experience. And one of the chapters that's sort of the most fun for me is there's a chapter called Passions that's just really one voice after another, that's what people love about the work. And that felt very like poetic and letting people really express that part of the experience felt very important. And in a way, everybody who was interviewed speaking as a poet, from their poet's voice, I guess.
Yeah, I think you were really open to the rhythms and the themes of these women's stories.
Well, what I wanted is to have people hear their stories the way I heard them.
Mm-hmm.
So to kind of capture that sense of the spoken story, and that's so riveting, and translate that onto the page.
Would you share something from Passions, that section
sure.
of the book of We'll Call You If We Need You, Experiences of Women Working Construction?
This is a woman, Lorraine Bertosa, who's a carpenter in Cleveland, Ohio. I worked on this Ohio building for 3 years. I was in heaven. The vibrations and excitement of these people actually putting this together, it was ongoing. Everything was cooking. It's like being a kid. We get to play with this and fix it and put it together and make it go, make it be actually there. There's nothing, and we put something there, and it's there. It's like a rock. It stays even. I mean, look at this amazing building that goes up to the sky. Part of working on this Ohio building that I loved a lot was being around the iron workers. The guys I work with were still walking with a lot of pride. I mean, who the hell can walk these beams up in the middle of the winter? I can't. Most guys can't. You'd never see most guys up there. It's a special breed of person. When I worked at the top, I was doing parapet walls on the edge of the building. We were hanging off the side on guy lines and safety belts. It was our own world. You'd go up there, didn't matter what else was going on in your life. You forget everything but what you have to do in front of you and your safety and your partner's safety. When you get a pause, you just take in the magnitude of where you are. You can see forever, you know, 45 stories up. It's something most people don't get to do. So when you get that pause, you don't start thinking about the problems in your life. You're just enjoying where you are. You become your own country, I think, up there. I just started walking taller after being around these iron workers. I felt I got respect from them. They weren't afraid to hand it out if you deserved it.
Hmm. Have you thought of doing a stage production of women's voices from construction, or have you done it?
Well, we did a, actually here at the Public Library in Boston, we did last month a stage reading from both books where three local tradeswomen did read stories of three tradeswomen from other parts of the country, and I read poems from Pioneering, and I had scripted it together to about an hour piece, and it was wonderful. There was a woman who was there in the audience who had been a Rosie the Riveter during World War II, and she said how much it resonated with her experiences. So it was very powerful. So, yeah, it is something to think about.
Mm-hmm. Now, have your experiences in your trade,
mm-hmm.
electrician, contributed to your voice as a poet?
Well, I think so. I think just in construction itself, because what I have a lot of interest in structure in poetry, and I think that some of that comes from just working with structures and. Like how far can you carry a line, or how convoluted can you make a sentence and still make it work? What kind of structure support interests me a lot.
Would you read to close with us a poem called Wire Talk?
Sure. Wire Talk. Working three floors apart, two mechanics at either end of a pipe, feed and pull in meter, keeping time through a Morse code of yanks and tugs, fingertips against the vocal cords of wire.
Wire Talk, Susan Eisenberg. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure, yeah.
Take care.
Thanks.
Susan Eisenberg has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. If you'd like to read more of her work, look for these books. It's A Good Thing I'm Not Macho, and Pioneering, Poems from the Construction Site, and the Nonfiction Oral History, We'll Call You If We Need You, Experiences of Women Working in Construction. Pioneering and We'll Call You are published by ILR Press, an imprint of Cornell University Press.